need some music?
Good evening, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news, behind the news, the story, behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion, or delusion that's going to determine what the future will bring, and I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls from out across the country at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But we ask that you hold your calls for the time being, because we have with us on the line right now, Mylon Martin. Mylon, are you there?
Yes, Dr. Stan, I sure am.
And Mylon Martin's an ordained minister, but he's written a book called Lucifer's Children that goes into the background of the spiritual battle in which we're currently engaged. And, of course, we carry the book, we carry the video that he's put together. And it gives you a tremendous insight into, of course, what's going on today. Because if you don't understand this spiritual battle, nothing really makes sense. So many things are happening. Let me just comment. I've been away for a couple of days. While I was gone, a former director of the Central Intelligence Agency, James Woolsey, had made a remark on a public television network talking about the fact that we are entering the Fourth World War. The Fourth World War is underway. Well, then, of course, if you begin the listening and you find the following day, a man named Frank Gaffney was on television defending remarks made by James Woolsey. And, of course, he was on opposite a professor of Arabic studies from Georgetown University, who said, you know, we shouldn't be talking about this fourth war. We should be talking about, you know, living in peace with the other Arab countries over there. We're just going to inflame those countries talking about this fourth world war that's going to involve the countries over there. Now, if you watch those programs, you probably are totally unaware of what was really happening. It just so happens that James Woolsey, former director of the CIA, was a member of this little group we call PNAC, the Project for the New American Century, and you go to their website, it's called www.newamericancentury.org, and you'll find out that back in 1997, they were already planning this war with Iraq, and to create a new international order that would benefit our principles and our prosperity, America would really run the world. And then if you then go and you look up the names of the people who organized this, one of them was Frank Gaffney. And so here you begin to see on national television members of this group. There can't be more than 50, 55 of them, and yet they control the Bush War Department, certainly James, Donald Rumsfeld, Dick Cheney, Paul Wolfowitz, John Boland, Frank Gaffney, James Woodsley, all of these people come from the PNAC group, and so Woolsey. So you have to understand how they're influencing public opinion with the help of the media. We are moving into the Fourth World War. the average American has no idea. And so with that as a background, I want you to listen to Mylan as he tells you the background of how he became interested in what's going on in the world today. Go ahead, Mylan. Why don't you introduce yourself to our listeners and tell them your opinion of what's going on, okay?
Well, thank you, Stan. I appreciate the opportunity to speak. And I have been watching the television like most Americans have been in days of late. And as a Christian, I have certainly been praying because this reminds me a lot of a 19, 20-year-old boy that used to live in Tulsa, Oklahoma, raised in Oklahoma, never been out of Oklahoma. And I found myself shipped out over across the seas, and as a 20-year-old boy, I found myself in Southeast Asia, defending myself, defending my country, and doing the best I thought I could do. And so as I look at these young men that are fighting here today, it brings back a lot of memories, Stan.
Well, I think that, of course, the one thing we wanted them to do, allow them to win the war and get it over with. I mean, certainly at this stage, it does no good at all to say, should we be there or shouldn't we be there? We're there. Let's finish the war. Let's win the war. And then let's bring our boys home. But I fear that that is not the real agenda. I feel that this is the beginning of a series of wars, and that's why understanding what the Project for the New American Century is and how these people, you'll suddenly see James Woolsey on television, you'll see Frank Gaffney on television, you'll see Gary Bauer on television, of course you'll see Wolfowitz and Rumsfeld and Cheney, but they're all part of, there's only not more than 50 people who are directing the entire course of American foreign policy, a policy that they began planning back in 1997, probably long before that. In fact, I really believe there are spiritual forces behind this whole policy of moving the world towards war.
Well, winning the war was this time, we do seem to be winning this war, and we're moving forward. Of course, back in the days of Vietnam, that was certainly not the case. You did not have to be in Vietnam very long to realize that we were not winning that war, was not on the agenda. And so it's definitely a different situation than it was back then. But certainly we have all been praying for these young men because, like you said, whether we like this war, whether we agree with it or not, we certainly are in it and we need to finish the job.
All right, fine. Well, why don't you tell a little bit about your experiences in Southeast Asia? And, of course, you got involved in drugs and the frustration of seeing the senseless death that was part and parcel of that, the Phoenix Project. And then, of course, how this all led you to a personal relationship with the Lord. And then that led you to begin to study the secret forces working behind the scenes, directing the course of world history.
Well, as a young man, I had just about to graduate from Oklahoma, or from high school, living in Tulsa, Oklahoma. In a period of about 15 months, I had attended almost a dozen funerals of various friends of mine who had been sent to Vietnam. Most of the friends were a year or two older than I was. And they had already been sent to Vietnam. And after attending nearly a dozen of these funerals, I was not looking forward to graduating. I was not looking forward, of course, to being drafted, which I thought was sure would happen, you know, as soon as I graduated. So, to make a long story short, I eventually did get drafted and went down and joined the Navy, hoping to maybe to avoid going to the fate of one of my best friends. Of course, I soon found myself in Vietnam as a minesweeper, sweeping the mouth of the DMZ. So in the military, in the what we call the Brown Water Navy, and it just wasn't long before I realized that there were some very strange things going on. I was there as a young man, hoping to serve my country, doing the best I could, and I soon found there was on our little minesweeper, there was a liaison officer that had lived in New York City and spoke very good English. And
he was Vietnamese?
He was a Vietnamese,
right.
Yes. But he had lived in America for a while and was a very highly educated man, very intelligent. And what we soon started doing, as soon as this liaison officer came on scene, is we started running rice patrols up and down the rivers during the DMZ.
Now, you were, what, on fairly small boats at this time?
Yes, there was two types of minesweepers, MSO, which was minesweeping ocean-going, and then there was the MSRs, which was went up and down and up in the rivers. So we would be on both, but we would go up the rivers in the MSRs. And but what we would do is run these rice patrols, and there certainly was rice being shipped up the rivers to the VC. But what we were doing was stopping these little junks, these little boats, and we'd search these boats, and if there was more rice on there than somebody could use, say, in a day or two, then we would confiscate them, and then we would, you know, we would interrogate the people. And it was my job to get these people on board and search their boats and then bring them back to talk to this one liaison officer. Well, to make a long story short, we were part of I later found out, I didn't know it at the time, what the name of it was. We were part of a program called Operation Phoenix. And what we really were doing was bringing these people on board, and this man would interrogate them. If he didn't like the answers to the questions that he got, when we would stop these boats, we would take these women and children back to our little encampment. And if he didn't like what was the answers to the questions that he asked them, he would usually take them out and back and shoot them.
Now, of course, this was really an effort to do away with the Viet Cong. They were trying to get rid of the Viet Cong supporters. And, of course, an awful lot of Americans thought we were really there to fight communism. War is a terrible thing. In war, people are injured, people are killed. And you had to stop the people who were supporting the Viet Cong. At least that was what the rationale was for killing people or hiring people, Vietnamese, to kill anybody who opposed our policy. Would that be a fair statement?
That is a fair statement. That is a fair statement. But, in fact, the reality was, and most, I don't know if I'd say most, but many of the people that we killed, executed during that program were innocent women and children.
Well, now, this was really a CIA program. This wasn't a military program, although the military was forced to work with CIA.
That's right. And I, as I began to, you know, as time went on, I began to know some of these people. Let's put it this way, I began to be friends with the Special Forces people who were associated with this program, this organization. Because as time went on, Stan, I really got to where I couldn't deal with the situation. I'd sometimes see these kids' faces in my sleep. I'd never taken drugs before, and yet I soon found myself taking drugs just to kill the pain of just the deadness of what was going on all the time, the people dying all around you. Your world had been turned upside down, and soon I was taking drugs just to kind of cope. And I did eventually get to be associated with some of the Special Forces, and I was always hearing rumors. They would tell me things, this, that, and the other. And, of course, I eventually did learn that it was CIA-backed and financed.
I think our listeners need to know that between the estimate is 40 to 60,000 people were killed in Phoenix by the Phoenix program, and you got paid for your assassinations by cutting off ears. And when we presented the ears, supposedly from the Viet Cong, why you got paid, but you got paid no matter as long as you had the ear. A horrible, horrible thing. Now, this has been suppressed in the United States, but there are books written on Operation Phoenix, and we can, at least any of you really want, I can give you references to them. I've talked to enough people who are with Phoenix and part of Phoenix, many of them idealistic military officers who could justify something they knew was morally wrong because they thought they were involved in something that was a greater good. Only afterwards did they really begin to realize that they had been used in this, what I believe is a totally evil undertaking. So then, Marlon, of course, this really began to get you. You got under drugs. And you actually found the Special Services was working with the CIA. Were they involved in drug smuggling, or was it just the CIA involved in drug smuggling?
Well, the drugs that I was buying, eventually I got I was thrown in military prison and discharged from the service. And my direct connection with this was always with the Special Forces people. But they knew what was going on. They were part and parcel of the Air America, the whole thing. The people that I got to know that I was buying my drugs were dealing directly with these people. So, yes, it was CIA was certainly involved in the whole thing, the flying of the drugs. It was open knowledge back then in that particular group that I was in. So, yes, the CIA has been involved with drugs, and the Special Forces worked hand in glove with them, and this is the group that I was working with. So, yes, it was common knowledge in the group that I ran with that that was the case.
So, anyway, you come back to the United States. You eventually get off of drugs. But when was it that you ran into this young man who was telling you about the people who really ran the world? Because somebody had to begin to explain to you that nothing that you'd been brought up to believe was really true. There were always these forces behind the scenes. Who was that?
Well, that was a young man that was in Special Forces. That happened before I left Vietnam. While I was over there, I would ask questions. I always was the type of person that had to know what was going on. So I had asked people around me in Mine Pack. I said, I'd say, how are we here? Why are we here? What are we doing here? How did we get in this mess? And people, nobody knew. The people around me didn't know. Superiors didn't know. You ask them a question, they couldn't tell you a thing. They didn't know any more about it than I did. They just say, shut up and shoot, Martin. Just shut up and shoot. Stop asking questions. But I've always wanted to know why. I ran into one of these Special Forces young men, very intelligent young guy. And his father was a New York stockbroker. And he understood how the world works. And that was the one young man that I could ask a question to, and I could get an intelligent answer, and he understood about something called the New World Order, something I had no concept of, never heard anything about. But when I began to ask him why we were in Vietnam, he was able to give me intelligent answers to my questions. He was able to tell me about how the CIA had been in there years ahead of time and had how some of the things they had done to get this war started. He had talked to me about the Kennedy assassination. He talked to me about something about the military-industrial complex, something I, again, as a 20-year-old kid, I'd never heard anything about, knew nothing about. And so I began to ask him. I said, well, why are we here? Who brought us here? What are we doing here? He explained to me the vast military-industrial complex that it took to build a war. He talked to me about how Kennedy had tried to stop the war and how these people had stopped him because they had spent billions of dollars tooling up for the war and they weren't about to let somebody like Kennedy come along and stop it. Well, that's the first I'd ever heard about the military-industrial complex. But then he went on. I began to ask him, who are these people? And he used a term I had never heard before. He said, they are the Illuminati. I said, the Illuminati what? And he said, the Illuminati. I said, well, no. What is the Illuminati? He said it's a group of worldwide global socialists that want to create a one world government and a one world religion, and the basis by which they're accomplishing that is a one world monetary system, which they have created through world banks, through central banks, coordinated through the IMF. So, of course, all this, as a 20-year-old kid, I never knew any of this, and I still didn't understand it, even as he began to explain it to me. But I knew that he could give me intelligent answers to my questions. This happened before I left Vietnam. But, Stan, it's hard to face the facts. Sometimes it's hard to face the truth, because as he began to explain all this, I began to realize that all my friends that were dying, that I, all those funerals I had gone to, I began to realize that these were deaths, these lives that were given up, were offered on the altar of corporate greed, that the people were making money off this war and they weren't about to let this thing stop.
But it was really more than money. I mean, certainly excuse that was given. It's all about money. But there's really a spiritual component to this desire for a world government under a ruling elite, which only later on I think that you really begin to understand that it was far more than simply greed, wasn't it?
Yes, because as you know, I spent more and more time talking to him, he eventually opened up to me and told me that I asked him, well, why do these people want to do what they're doing? I mean, you know, and he eventually brought up the topic of the occult. I didn't even know at the time what the word occult meant.
Well, I can imagine, you know, when I first heard about these things, I thought that's the most ridiculous thing I ever heard. But only after you begin to read and study, and then you begin to get the occult writings as we have, and you begin to understand there really is a spiritual hierarchy that rules the world. And anybody would like to see their pamphlet that they published telling about the spiritual hierarchy and their people, give us a call. It's called The Spiritual Hierarchy. Call us at 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Ask for it. We're going to be back here in just a moment with Mylon Martin. Okay, well, this is Dr. Stan, and so we're basically talking about your experience. A young man in the Special Forces is telling you about the people who really run the world, and then eventually he begins talking about the occult, about the spiritual component behind this whole effort to create a new world order, a new world religion. So pick up the story from there, Mylon.
Well, as he began to explain these things to me, I had a hard time. I could believe some of the things that he told me, but I still had a hard time understanding the occult part of it, because I certainly thought to myself, well, I could understand the communists doing something like this. I could understand this, that, or the other, but, you know, to a bunch of occultists, I just, at the time, it was just more than I could believe. So I discounted much of what this young man said, but then yet I had to accept the fact that what he was explaining to me, I was beginning to see it. And eventually, of course, I was still selling drugs, and this eventually led to the fact that I got discharged out of the military. And I was thrown in Long Beach Military Prison, placed in solitary confinement, bread and water for quite a while. And while I was waiting my discharge, I was in a cell, and I'd sit there for days on end, counting the brads on the wall. I had two or three pet cockroaches. I could tell them from across the room. I had them named, and I was trying to do anything to occupy my time while I was waiting there. And one night, as the Marine guards turned out the lights, a young Marine guard walked by and kicked a Good News for Modern Man book, an old, rugged Good News for Modern Man, underneath my cell door.
A Bible, basically.
Yes, it's an easy-read translation. Bible is just the New Testament. Well, to make a long story short, I grabbed that book up, and I read that book till the day that I left that cell. And I eventually, during that cell, I accepted the Lord Jesus Christ as my personal Savior and asked Him to turn my life around. So that's how my life got turned around, how I got off drugs, and I eventually came back to Oklahoma and attended two seminaries and eventually went into the ministry and have pastored for several years since. But during those years I pastored, for years I had tried to study this New World Order, this occult-based religion. And it's like you said, Stan, this is a spiritual war that we are in, not just a war of a natural people trying to establish natural political goals. We are fighting a spiritual war. And people have to realize that. These people are very, very intelligent people. And they really do believe completely in what they're doing. It's what their belief is, what they believe, that is very hard to believe. So for years I began to study this thing and began to realize that the groups that control the New World Order are basically Luciferian.
Now, right, we're going to just hold that idea and that thought. We're going to have to wait until we rejoin our listeners up in the Great Northwest. And then, of course, we want to develop this idea that there really are groups that, frankly, worship Lucifer, one of the hardest concepts for people to believe in this day and age.
That's true.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest is Mylon Martin. His book, Lucifer's Children. If you'd like to know more about that, you can give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. There's a book, there's a video, and Mylon has been telling us that, of course, he was in Southeast Asia, got onto drugs, and then, of course, when he was brought back to the United States, placed in solitary confinement, and then, of course, somebody had given him a Bible, and he began to read the Bible, and it was when he was in solitary confinement that he accepted the Lord, then got out of the service, went to a Bible college, became a minister. But even when he was pastoring churches, he was studying the background, trying to understand what motivates this small clique of people working at the leadership of both political parties, and, of course, making mockery out of the concept of democracy, even having captured control of the reins of the Central Intelligence Agency, and, of course, controlling the wealth and most of the media of our nation. What propels them? Why do they really want a one-world government, a new world religion? So you pick up the story there, Mylon.
Well, as I continued to study this, Stan, I began to realize that the basis of this whole religion behind the New World Order was, at its very core, based on Manichaeism, which is a form of an offshoot, you might say, of Zoroastrianism, and it's part of the ancient Gnostic dualistic mystery religions.
All right, could you explain to our listeners what Zoroastrianism is, how that ties into Manichaeism, and how that ties into the spiritual battle that is being fought today that most people don't even recognize?
Well, if you study Satanism and Luciferianism, you'll find that the basis of it is Gnostic dualism. Gnostic means hidden. Dualism is the concept that there are two worlds out there, one good and one bad. And that is the basis of most of the Gnostic belief systems.
And of course, one is headed by God and the other is headed by Satan, or the good God and the evil God. The only trouble is that they think the evil God is the good God, and that the God we worship is the evil God. That is the most incredible thing. Of course, that carries over from, of course, Zoroastrianism into Manichaeism, and then into the very real battle that we fought today. The only trouble is most Christians don't know the battle is going on.
That's true, Stan. That really is true. Most of us are beating the air, kind of like Paul said. We're swinging wildly. We don't even really know who our enemies are. We name humanism, we name socialism, we name a lot of isms, but we don't really understand that the basis of this whole concept, those of us like me and you who are fighting this battle against the New World Order, we need to know who our enemy is so we know how to best fight him. So this is one of the things I was trying to do, is to be able to study and understand who my enemy is once I narrowed down to understanding this religion. It's like you said, these people believe that the God of the Bible, of the Christian and Jews, that he is the evil God, the black God, the bad God, and yet they believe that the Lucifer, the light bearer, is the real God, the good God that has come to loose all of us from our spiritual blindness. Being blinded by the evil God, Jehovah.
Now, I think it's so important that people understand the reason that they believe that way is because the God of the Bible has all these rules. Thou shalt not do this, thou shalt not do that, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not commit adultery, thou shalt not bear false witness, thou shalt not covet. Well, you're not free when you've got all those rules. They want a God that gives them complete freedom to do whatever they want to do. They think that that is freedom, whereas exactly that is the antithesis of freedom. Freedom is not the ability to do what you want to do, or freedom is the ability to do what you should do according to God's laws and God's rules. So they have embraced the God that gives them total freedom and moral anarchy and all the things that, of course, are going on in our society today. Would that be a fairly good statement?
That's absolutely true, Stan. And I first stumbled onto this as I was doing my studies of Platoism And I began to study some of the ancient Greek philosophies that is associated with dualism. And, of course, one of those philosophers, probably the best known, is Plato. And Plato, if you read his Republic and his various writings, read his writings about the lost continent Atlantis, and one of the themes of his everything he says and writes was the fact that, of course, Plato was a bisexual. He had very little regard for the family, and he had very real ideas, very definite ideas about how the family should work, how the world should work, how governments should work. And it was based on these ancient mystery cults and religions that he was basically tied up in and associated in.
All right, we're going to be back here in just a moment with Mylon Martin, and we'll welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is Mylon Martin. We're talking about his book, The Lucifer's Children, and his video, Lucifer's Children, where he tells this story, and you get a chance to meet Mylon through the miracle of videos. But, of course, you were talking about Plato, and really Plato's Republic and the society he advocated at that time is exactly what is happening today. And in other words, a ruling elite, a military class, everybody else enslaved. And, of course, the American people are accepting this today in the name of fighting the wicked terrorists. And in the name of fighting terrorism, we're giving up our freedom. We're establishing a surveillance society. Everybody's being watched. I went to the airport today, and everybody dutifully sits there or stands there is being searched. They take off their shoes because, of course, we know that they can put explosives in shoes because of the mad bomber, John Reed, who was going to blow up the plane because he had CD4 in the sole of his shoes. Of course, anybody who studied that realizes the whole thing was a scam. Poor Mr. Reed will spend the rest of his life in prison as an Al-Qaeda terrorist because he was trying to light C4. Now, you can't light C4 and get it to explode. You can burn C4 as a source of heat, but it won't explode without blasting caps. The whole thing was, of course, to create the perception that anybody could have explosives in their shoes. And, of course, John Reed, obviously the people who gave him the shoes with the explosives in it were smart enough to know that you can't set off C4. You don't work with C4 without realizing, of course, you have to have blasting caps. But they created that perception in the minds of the American people, and we know that the terrorists are out there. And yet, isn't it interesting that since September 11th, with the one exception of the anthrax attack, with anthrax that obviously had come from our own military laboratories by one means or another, that there have been no other terrorist attacks with all of these Al-Qaeda here in the United States just waiting. Maybe things are not what they appear to be. Maybe reality usually is scoffed at. Illusion usually is king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it will be reality, not illusion or delusion. That'll determine what the future will bring. Well, Mylon has, of course, done a great job in his book talking about, Plato's writing. So why don't you pick up the story from there, Mylon?
Well, Stan, we certainly are being socially engineered. Our minds are being guided along in this pathway. And among the things I studied was the Hegelian dialectic. Talking about Plato again, I began to realize that Plato had a definite idea about how to create a society, how to manage a society. He had an understanding how you would socially engineer a society, basically brainwash them. But his views on society, he really believed in having a three-tiered society, a gold, silver, and a bronze. He wanted to break society up, actually breed people into this caste system. And the gold would be a small group of elite that would be the real true citizens. They would own all the land. They would be the ones to make all the decisions. They would be the businessmen, the doctors, and the lawyers. And they would be the educated, the elite. And they would be held in power by the silver class, which would be a military class, a military caste system, bred for the specific purpose of holding them in power and controlling them, protecting them from the great unwashed masses of the bronze people.
That's like you and me.
Yeah, well, that's the peons out there. That's the ones who do all the work, and those are the ones. They would be a bronze class would be basically bred for their docile, to be docile, to be easily led. And you know, you was talking about being at the airport. Well, we certainly are a society today who are easily led and docile, and we're just like sheep to the shearers. Most Americans don't have a clue as to what's going on.
Sure, well, that's why they dumb down our children in the schools intentionally and purposely, haven't taught them specifically how not to read and read well or spell well or pursue excellence at all, because, of course, the serfs, the underclass, you never want them very, very smart. They won't want to go along with the system. The one thing in the Old South under slavery, the one thing you never want to do was to teach a slave how to read and write. So anyway, of course, this is what Plato wanted. And if you read occult literature today, you will find out that's exactly what they keep talking about. You read New Age, Plato comes up repeatedly, the idea of lost Atlantis, and reinstituting Atlantis in America is to lead the whole world into this wonderful society that one time existed before it was destroyed by the Great Flood. That would be Atlantis.
Yes, very much at the core of all this belief system is this theory that this ancient continent of Atlantis existed. And, of course, at the top of that chain was the ten kings, the elite, and then, of course, the whole structure of that. And as foolish as some people, you know, if you do I go around and speak, and I oftentimes will kind of take a little poll and find out how many people believe that the lost continent of Atlantis actually existed, and you'll get about 50-50 people who believe that it's just a fable and not real, and then others will believe that at least there's something to it. And and of course you see the lost continent of Atlantis on television all the time. Seem like we can't seem to see anything but that anymore on television, but this is very much at the core of what these people actually want to do, and that is to establish an elite. And if you mentioned the dumbing our children down, this was the whole idea. They would not be taught any more than what they needed to be taught, and they would be raised by the state. In fact, Plato, because he was a bisexual, didn't really have a lot of regard for the family. You and I know that the family unit is the basis of Western civilization established by God. Plato, however, believed that there really shouldn't be a family, that all the women should belong to all the men to all the women, and that the children that came about by these unions, if you want to call it a union, should be raised by the state, and that they should be educated according to the gifts and the talents that the state saw in the children, unhampered, of course, by any parental ideas about how they should be raised, you see. So there you go. You have the basis right there of much of our educational system today, and the NEA and the whole idea that the state actually owns our kids and that they have the right to raise them the way the state sees it. So you can see right there at the basis of much of what the communists believe right there, Stan.
Sure. But, of course, unfortunately, many of these same ideas are being adopted right here in the United States. And we have the Child Abuse Agency. And, of course, if they can get your children away or find some excuse, they get $25,000 reward to spend on goodies, for their department. So there is a real financial incentive to take children away from parents and put them under the care of the state. And then they have its own court system, for this juvenile court system. And of course, you get into that court system, you're going to lose. That's the way it's set up. And because the parents really have lost the right to their children, because we've accepted this platonic idea that the children really don't belong to the state, and the state has to protect them from the parent.
And of course, now we're getting into the situation where the corporations are going in and marrying up with the school systems, and the more this thing works its way out, the more and more you see Plato's ideas in this whole thing.
Well, of course, you're talking about the workforce education, where, of course, the school will determine what sort of a future your child's going to have, and then they will be specifically educated for the jobs that the corporations need. because, of course, many of the, not all corporations, but certain of the corporations are part and parcel of this, because Lucifer rewards those who follow him, and he rewards them very well with wealth and sexual favors and all of these things, and, of course, things of the flesh are what appeal to people who do not believe in the God of the Bible.
That's absolutely true, Stan. And we certainly are in a spiritual war, and we need to realize that we need to recognize our enemy. Our enemy is not different racial groups we might point to that would be, that some have say, runs the New World Order. Our enemy is Satan, and we need to recognize who he is and to aim our efforts towards him, understanding that we have a real spiritual battle here. Those of us who are Christians and those of us who believe the Bible certainly have an advantage here, but Stan, as I go out and speak to different groups, you'd be surprised how many so-called Christian groups out there don't even believe in the existence of the devil.
That's because, of course, they've changed the message of the church. They infiltrated our seminaries half a century ago. And they raised a whole generation of ministers who don't believe in hell, they don't believe in Satan, they don't believe in the spiritual battle. They've even changed the various attributes of God. God would never be a God of judgment or of justice, or he would never destroy nations or destroy people or punish anybody. He's simply a God of love. And God has a wonderful plan for your life, and he loves you. And of course, if you come into Christianity with that thought, what happens when everything falls apart? What happens when this country is plunged into chaos? Then where do you turn? I saw Germany after the Second World War, and behind the facades of the buildings, as far as you could see the rubble. And the other thing you would see, the churches all standing empty. Why? Because the people knew they'd been lied to by their ministers, that the message that had been taught, the Romans 13 that they were preaching in the churches in Adolf Hitler's Germany, where the churches told the people, you should go along with Adolf Hitler. After all, God put him there. And not only that, but obviously these must be the end times. You're going to be raptured out of here. Nothing bad is ever going to happen to the German people. And they realized, of course, only when it was too late, that they'd been misled by their ministers. So the message of today, people have to understand, that had our founding fathers believed in Romans 13 and the gospel that's being taught in America today, we'd still be English subjects. It was basically the American clergy that, of course, created the American Revolution and led to this once great Christian nation that we have tragically lost today. So pick up the story from there, Marlon.
Well, Stan, in my book, Lucifer's Children, in chapters 12, 13, and 14, those three chapters are based on Hitler. Chapter 12 is Hitler's secret occult war. Chapter 13 is Hitler's holy war on the church. And in chapter 14, who financed Adolf Hitler? In those three chapters, I basically talk about what you just mentioned there. You were talking about your experience there. Hitler came in during World War II and actually took over the church. And the church began to be one of his greatest allies. And unfortunately, as I see the events that come before me today, and as I speak in various churches, I begin to see that this whole scenario that Hitler was able to do, this blindness that was on the German people at that time, that they actually welcomed Hitler in, even the Protestants. Protestants and Catholics both, but there were Protestants and Catholics both that saw through what he did. And they began to speak out. But the vast majority, both Protestant and Catholic, welcomed much of what Hitler was trying to do. They took their youth groups and incorporated them into Hitler's youth. And so it was a marriage of church and state in Germany. And it's amazing what went on there. I see it set up today where it could just exactly happen just like it did in Germany back then.
Sort of like deja vu all over again.
Yes.
Okay, fine. Well, anyway, of course, your book, of course, goes extensively into all these various secret organizations. But as you begin studying the various secret organizations, don't they all have sort of a common basis, a common goal, a common objective?
Yes, they do. They want to establish a one-world government, but the idea is to have a one-world religion. And I give many quotes, Albert Pike in my book. I give a lot of different quotes in there talking about something called the New World Order, because this is the basis of their religion. They want to establish a New World Order. And what did Lucifer tell the people back then? He said, you can be as God. What did he tell Eve? You can be as God, knowing good and evil. And this is the basis of the New World Order and this one world Luciferic religion, that you can be a God. Stan, we can become God. We don't need the Holy Spirit to do it either.
And of course, the thing that most people never want to admit, that this plan is for the United Nations to become the world one world government. Now, how can we make that statement? Very simply, because I read the occult literature, and I'm sure you have as well, Mylon, and they will tell you, you know, the United Nations will become the world government with a world court and a world army and a world tax and a world parliament and world laws and an international criminal court is one of the basic tenets of this whole thing. And, of course, what are our leaders talking about? Oh, we want to get the United Nations involved as far as Iraq, you know, once, of course, we've got rid of the wicked Saddam Hussein, then maybe we could turn the oil there, oil revenues over to the United Nations, or let them begin to control this new government that's going to be set up to bring democracy to this area. There's never been a democracy in Iraq. Loved, beautiful idea. But why don't we set up a Republican form of government rather than a Democrat form of government? After all, America's a republic, not a democracy. So why are we setting up a system which even Plato admitted in his Republic said democracies always degenerate into despotism? And yet, of course, that is what where our boys are fighting for, to establish a democracy in Iraq, exactly as we went over in the first Gulf War to, of course, bring freedom back to the people in Kuwait. The only trouble is the people of Kuwait had no freedom. They had a dictatorship, a monarchy there, and as soon as we got through in Kuwait, we turned the government back over to the monarchy, to the dictator. So, you know, you say one thing because it appeals to the public, but what is the real goal? What is the real objective? And my fear is that, of course, Iraq is simply the first in a series of wars, as James Woolsey said, why we are moving into the Fourth World War, the Third World War having been the Cold War, the Fourth World War, with a series of wars that are going to follow, and we will never again see peace as we've known it. And the tragedy is, in times like that, how people tend to rally behind the government without realizing that behind that government is the prince of this world.
Well, Stan, you know, everywhere we turn today, we listen about the authority of the United Nations, giving the authority of the United States, United Nations, the power to dictate what's going on. Well, in my book, I document the founders of the United Nations, how it came to be. We talk about the Rockefellers, the Carnegie Foundation, and the various groups, and some of the occult groups that worked in and through these foundations, and how they established the United Nations. They fought World War One to establish the League of Nations. It failed, and so of course they had to have another war to finally establish this thing. And now today we have the United Nations, and we're fighting today to establish the rule of the United Nations over this world. The United Nations will be very much used by Lucifer in this last battle, this last spiritual battle that we're going to be fighting here, because this is part and parcel of his. This global plan is to establish this United Nations, and it will be a tool in Lucifer's hands to direct the people of the earth.
And every Luciferian knows that, and if you'd like to read the writings of Share magazine, we could send you a couple of pages from the things they sent out, telling how the United Nations, and how, after all, everybody's diverted by the talk of war, but the officials in the United Nations are working quietly towards the establishment of this government, and they tell you that their leader, their world leader, is about to emerge. Now, they're not talking about the God of the Bible. They're talking about the Antichrist, who they are looking forward to ruling with him over the world. And you say that couldn't be going on. If it was going on, certainly we'd hear about it. Well, you would not hear about it if the prince of this world and his agents controlled the media, would you? But if you want to verify what we're saying, give us a call, 1-800-544-8927. Ask for the latest things that come out of Share Magazine, where they're talking about how, of course, this whole thing is moving towards, number one, the United Nations, and number two, the coming world leader. And, of course, their pamphlet on the spiritual hierarchy and how their agents rule the world. Madeline, we're just about out of time. Whenever we have you on, we ought to usually like to have you on for a couple of hours sometimes in the evening. There's so much to cover. So what are your parting thoughts for our listeners this evening? What message would you leave with them? You know, we don't want to leave them with this feeling of hopelessness, but really what an exciting time we live in to know the Lord.
Well, Stan, I read the back of the book, and we win. The Christians have a hope, and our hope is the Lord Jesus Christ. And I'd like to say at the very end of this, I need to point everybody towards prayer and to point everybody to the Lord, because the Lord is where we have our hope. It's in him. And I'd certainly like to encourage all of our listeners to pray for these young men as they go through this mop-up procedure over there in Iraq, to pray for the protection of these young men, and that they would turn their life as they see the... Some of them certainly will see things that they've never seen before, and probably it'd be a lot of emotional scars there. So we need to pray for these young men, that begin to look to the Lord as their source. So I would like to do that, Stan, just to point people towards prayer and to point people towards the Lord Jesus Christ.
Well, amen to that. Well, let's just take a couple of minutes here, and because I really think let's take about 3 or 4 more minutes. You know, and if people understand that this is a spiritual battle that's being fought on a political and ideological and cultural battlefield, it really all makes sense. For our listener out there, if you don't subscribe to our newsletter, if you have not gotten a copy before, give us a call, and we'll be glad to send you a copy of the March newsletter. Specifically request that. And we simply give you a chronology of the events that happened, how the Project for the New American Century began planning for the Iraqi War back in 1997 and 1998. And then, of course, they called, they said we're not going to be able to carry out our programs unless there's a catastrophic and catalytic event like another Pearl Harbor. They said that in the report just 12 months before of the catastrophic and catalytic event of September 11th, the year 2001. And then, of course, remember it was just 2 days later, 3 days later, when former Senator Gary Hart addressed a meeting of the Council on Foreign Relations, which is dedicated to the New World Order. And he said, you know, there is a chance the President of the United States can use this catastrophe or use this tragedy to create what his father talked about, and I think it was only once, and that is a New World Order. There is a chance the President of the United States can use this tragedy to create what his father talked of perhaps only once, and that is a New World Order. And, of course, that's exactly what this is all about. They're going to use this to create the New World Order. And until people understand that, but how would then September 11th create the New World Order? Well, first of all, America now controls Afghanistan. America will soon control Iraq. And we will have troops permanently stationed there. But, of course, this is simply the first two instances in a series of wars that have long been planned that I believe will ultimately result in the third, or call it the fourth world war. Call it what you will. But I believe we're moving from war to war to war. What are your thoughts on that, Marlon?
Well, I do believe, just like you, Stan, that we are socially being engineered. It's the Hegelian dialectic process, and they're going to bring us into a conflict, into a situation where every person in America is going to be tempted to give away all of our constitutional rights. We're going to be calling for peace and safety, and we're going to be processed to the place where we'll be willing to give up all of our constitutional rights, our guns. We'll call for people to record everything we say, to put cameras on every street corner, anything, just to give us peace and safety, to give us some rest. because they have stressed us. They got us under stress, and that's the easiest way to socially engineer people. So it is a case of the Hegelian dialectic process.
And you know, it's the most amazing thing. 4 weeks ago, the French and the German were our allies. Now they're our enemies. 4 weeks ago, of course, we were close to the Russians. Now we're drawing away from the Russians. You know, we're beginning to look askance at Syria and Iran and the Russians, who are all helping the Iraqis. You know, our boys are over there fighting the Iraqis. And everything has changed, but it didn't change just by accident. It has all been scripted. When you understand this is long-range scripting, if you understand that this Third World War is planned a long, long time ago, the third try at the New World Order, as H.G. Wells wrote about in his book, The Shape of Things to Come, and said it would all originate, he thought it was originated about 1988 when he wrote his book, but he was a few years off, but it was all going to center around something that would happen in a place called Basra. And of course, we've been reading about Basra here recently. Mylan, thank you so much, very much, for being with us. It's always a pleasure having you as a guest here at Radio Liberty.
It's been a pleasure, Stan.
Good night. God bless you.
Thank you.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when, of course, we want to mention to our listeners that Radio Liberty is listener-supported. If you're out there in the listening audience and you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters and help us as we try to educate people across America, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And then if you'd like a free copy of our newsletter, you can give us a call. And I think I'd probably get the March newsletter. I think it gives you an excellent overview of what's going on and how everything that is happening is really part and parcel of this movement towards the New World Order, the New World Religion. And then, of course, we hope many of you will go to our website at radioliberty.com. And you need to perhaps think about what you may do if we do have real serious problems in this home, how you can begin to prepare yourself. Just go to our website at radioliberty.com, and you certainly will find our radio programs there, or how you can get them 5 hours a day. You can find out how to get our newsletters. They're posted there going back over many years, and you have our permission to pull them down and to copy them and get them distributed. If you don't believe that there is a master plan to eliminate a large part of the population of the earth, as is described in Revelation 6, 8, and the subsequent chapters, when the vast majority of the world are killed off, read my Population Control Agenda monograph and see what these elitists say about the necessity to kill off large parts of the world's population. That's the Population Control Agenda monograph. It's up on my website. And then, of course, we certainly hope that you'll tell others about our radio programs. We hope that you'll tell others about our website and encourage them to listen, because that is how we're getting more and more people involved. And, of course, we're really excited as we're expanding our coverage. We're going to be now 2 hours on the Sunshine Network in upstate New York every afternoon. That'll be from 6 to 8 in the evening. We've been playing there from 6 to 7 in the evening, but an awful lot of people are eating dinner at that time. But now we'll go from 6 to 8, so we hope that we'll pick up and expand our listening audience in that region. And that's how, little bit by little bit, we're expanding knowledge about what's going on. And as people begin listening to our program and understanding the Internet, and then, of course, they begin to tell others, and others begin listening to the Internet, and gradually we are reaching more and more people across America. It's exciting to go speaking, as I did here yesterday. I was talking in Pasadena and ran into a couple that listened to our program every evening on the Internet. And, of course, for those of you who don't like to sit in front of your computer, we have a little a radio transmitter you can hook onto your computer and listen. You can listen any place in your house, certainly with an FM radio, or you can certainly get a set of earphones down at Radio Shack, and that way you can plug that into your computer, and then you can go anywhere in the house and listen with those earphones, so you don't have to sit glued to the computer. There are all sorts of things that you can do. The important thing is, of course, to get the information and then, of course, disseminate it to others. And lastly, of course, we ask you to pray for our boys overseas and for their families and for the civilians over there to limit the amount of death and destruction. We ask you to pray for revival in America, for our leaders, and Lastly, we ask you to pray for our ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. So until tomorrow at the same time, I guess Monday now, when we'll be back with you, Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing in the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls because we have with us a new guest this evening. Her name is Diane Wilson. She lives over in Morgan Hill, but she's written a fascinating book called The Awakening of a Jehovah's Witness, Escape from the Watchtower Society. Diane, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Well, thank you so much for being with us. And this is really a fascinating book because, of course, it's the story of a young woman lost and, you know, involved in an unhappy marriage and, of course, with a son, really looking for some stability. And, of course, she's introduced to the Watchtower Society. She's introduced to Jehovah's Witnesses and really what an appealing situation this is, because here there's security and loving and caring. But of course, with that security and loving and caring is the loss of her identity, of her will. So I'm going to let you tell, why don't you tell the story of how you got involved with Jehovah's Witnesses and what this really means to you and to so many other people who have been approached to join this organization and have dedicated their life to the beliefs that are laid out by the hierarchy of this organization.
Okay, I'll start with how I became a witness. I was actually raised as a Methodist, and when I moved to from the East Coast to the West Coast, I became involved with Presbyterian Church, and I quickly became disillusioned because the minister one day stood up and said, "The reason I go to the hospital and hold the hand of the sick is because you pay me to do it." And I was so shocked that I just dropped out of the church completely. And right at that time, my sister-in-law had been studying with Jehovah's Witnesses, and so I was kind of ripe to hear what this different group was going to say. And she kept talking to me about Armageddon. Armageddon is this God's battle against people on the earth, the wicked of the earth, but only Jehovah's Witnesses will survive.
Now, what is there, 144,000 of them that survive? Is that it?
No, they believe that there's an unlimited number who can survive Armageddon, but the 144,000, that's the limited number of people who would inherit heavenly life. So that number is limited, in that those 144,000 are chosen among all the people that ever lived, and they will rule with Jesus as kings and priests in heaven, and they will rule over the earth.
All right, fine. So, but now, what is this Armageddon that they're talking about? Is this the Battle of Armageddon that the evangelical Christian has talked about?
Well, I'm not too sure what they talk about because I'm not familiar too much with their teachings, but the witnesses believe that it's the great day of the war of the God Almighty, and that he and the angelic forces will destroy all the wickedness from the earth. It's just that the witnesses have a little bit different view of what wickedness is. They view that anyone who is not a Jehovah's Witness is wicked and therefore deserves destruction at Armageddon. And this is what is so behind their fervence to go knocking door to door, because they feel they are actually saving people. Come be a witness. Actually, there's a song in the Witness Songbook that says, come to the Ark of Salvation, come to Jehovah's organization. And they liken it to Noah's Ark in the back of the day of the flood. So they feel that you have to be in the organization to survive this Armageddon.
Now, of course, initially they felt that this was all going to happen in 1975, is that right?
Well, I became involved with the witnesses around 1968, and so 1975 was the excitement of the day, but it wasn't until after I left the organization and I started researching its history that they also said, oh, Armageddon is going to happen in 1874, and when it didn't happen, oh, Armageddon is going to happen in 1914. I didn't know these things. I thought 1975 was the date and the only date.
So that was about the third time that they'd been wrong as far as when this all was going to come on down.
Yeah, and they constantly view Armageddon as being just around the corner. It's still ever imminent. It's going to happen.
All right, fine. And of course, when you get into the Jehovah's Witnesses, your life seems to center all around that, and you're not allowed to criticize or question or anything else. You just have to accept blindly the teachings of the Watchtower.
Absolutely, you're not allowed to have any questions, any doubts, any disagreements. And if you do, they will throw you out. It's called disfellowshipping. They throw you out of the group, and they make it a public announcement to the congregation about this. And no witness from that point forward is able to talk to you. They can't even have eye contact with you.
Now, what about if it's somebody in your family that has left?
Well, that happened to me. They disfellowshipped my daughter when she was 18 years old, and they told me I can never talk to her again in my whole life. I can't write to her. I can't talk to her on the phone. I can't visit her. I can't even talk about her to other people unless she repents and becomes a witness again.
And, of course, this is how a cult works. In other words, you have to do exactly what they say. If you don't, why, of course, you are tossed out. And then you lose everything because all of your friends are there. And suddenly you're without friends, without support. It must be a pretty terrifying thing.
It really is, because they threatened me. They said it was very traumatic to me to lose my daughter in this way. And they said, you have to pretend she's dead. You cannot talk to her. And if you do talk to her or write to her, then we will throw you out too. And it's so frightening because they teach you that the world outside of the Jehovah's Witness, the little microcosm of the organization, the world outside of that, they say it's like a big black hole that Satan rules, and they're going to suck you in there if you don't watch out. So it's very frightening to be thrown out. You think you're being tossed out into Satan's midst.
Well, now, of course, what did you do as far as your daughter was concerned?
I'm sad to say that I did shun her for 3 months. I tried to do what I thought was right, but it tore my heart out. And after 3 months of this, I thought, this is not helping her, and it's not going to make her come back. And she needs my help. She's a young woman out in the world all by herself. And I couldn't believe that a loving God would require this. So that's when my exodus started. My daughter's leaving, her being disfellowshipped is really the catalyst for my change, because this was so painful to do.
All right, fine. And it was that when you, did you leave at that time, or you gradually got away from it?
At that time, I became inactive. I stopped going to the meetings, because as long as you're going there, you're hearing the constant repetition of these doctrines. I needed to get away from that. I needed to start to learn how to think, because they do not allow any independent thinking at all. You just believe in everything the Watchtower says, and the Watchtower has rules that cover everything, practically.
Now, there's a small group of men. How many are there? Was it Washington, D.C. or New York? Where are they? That actually, of course, get these revelations from God that they pass down through the Watchtower magazine.
It's in New York City.
All right.
In Manhattan. They have a Watchtower factories back there. And that's where the governing body resides.
And how many people are there in that governing body?
They're all men, and they're usually elderly, and it varies between 11 and 17.
All right. And, of course, and then how do they finance this? Do they make demands for payment to the Watchtower Society?
No, they don't. And they don't pass a collection plate, as churches do either. But they do have, and they make a big deal about that. We don't ask for money. Jehovah will provide. But they do have a contribution box that sits in a very prominent spot, so anybody walking by it is expected to donate. But they also make a lot of money off their many, many publications. That big factory in New York where the world headquarters is, they just turn out, well, they make the Watchtower and Awake magazine. Those are each twice a month. And in addition to that, they're always turning out new books. Every year they turn out new books. It's basically the same information under a new cover. And all the witnesses are expected to buy one of these for every member of their family, even the babies. And then, of course, they have to go house to house, and they're really selling the book, but they don't call it that. They say we're placing the book with people for a donation. But they do make quite a bit on that, even though they say that they're only asking the publication price. It's not really true. I've talked to men who have worked there who are now out of the Watchtower, and they say the Watchtower is a very rich organization. They make a lot of money on their books.
But, of course, it's really this sort of fear of being dropped from the society, and then, of course, you will be in this black hole ruled by Satan, and, of course, no blessing by God if you do leave the Watchtower or you disobey.
Right. It's a very scary thing to even be thinking about leaving. The fear holds you in the organization. Fear is such a major factor. Fear that Jehovah is going to destroy you at Armageddon if you leave the organization can keep you held in it, no matter how unhappy you are in it. Fear of life outside the organization. Witnesses are actually indoctrinated with a phobia of ever leaving the organization. They're almost taught to self-destruct if they leave.
Well, now you tell about how you got started, and you wanted to go to a kingdom hall, that's what they call them, in a neighboring area. And when you went there, you weren't welcome at all. You were told, or you were supposed to go to the one in your area, and you were going to be just tossed out of the organization for daring at any time to question what you'd been told what to do. Is that right?
Yes, that's true. I started out in one kingdom hall, and then I moved from one city to the next city. They're real close together, and I had gotten to know the witnesses at that first kingdom hall. So when I moved, I kept going there, or I thought I was going to keep going there. Somehow the witnesses there knew that I had moved. And when I went there, like I usually did every Sunday, they said, "What are you doing here?" And that's how I was met, and I was not welcome. And I knew that I would have to go to the kingdom hall in the new city in order to be welcomed.
Well, now, you actually were told, though, that only going one time a week was not sufficient. You had to go how often a week?
Oh, well, in the beginning, they just want you to come for the public talk on usually Sunday mornings. But after you start getting involved in it, they demand more and more of your time, and eventually they want you to go to 5 meetings a week.
Well, in other words, you were so completely immersed in this that you don't have time to think about anything else.
Yes, that's right, and they really don't encourage you to read outside materials at all, magazines, books, novels, nothing like that. They don't forbid that, although they do forbid reading anything that is critical of the Watchtower Society. It's absolutely forbidden. You cannot read anything about another religion. If you go into a Christian bookstore, you'll be disfellowshipped and thrown out.
Well, one of the things, of course, is when I practiced medicine, was very, very apparent to us, and that is that people would come in that need major surgery, but they would say, "Well, of course, I can't take a blood transfusion."
Right.
What's that all about? And these people would stick to this sometimes, even at the very the danger to their own lives, the lives of their loved ones, or they would have to tell them, "Well, we can't operate on you. You don't want blood transfusions. We can't take care of you because we couldn't be responsible for your dying if you wouldn't allow us to transfuse you.
Right. Well, where that comes from is a scripture in the book of Genesis, chapter 9, verses 3 and 4, and it says, only flesh with its soul, its blood, you must not eat. And then in the New Testament, in the book of Acts, chapter 15, verse 29, it says, keep abstaining from blood. Now, they have, most religions view that to be talking about eating blood, and the witnesses, you know, do have that interpretation of it as well, is that we're forbidden to eat blood in any form, blood sausages and so forth. But they go a step farther, and they're saying that if you take a blood transfusion, you are actually eating the blood. What they're not realizing is that the circulatory system is a separate system than the digestive system. And if you take blood by swallowing it, it's a much different effect on the body than if you inject it in the vein. It's more like a liquid tissue. You've already got blood in your veins. So that's where that comes from, that forbidden.
Well, I know that many years ago, we lived next to a Jehovah's Witness family, and they wouldn't allow their children to say the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag. What was that all about?
Oh, yes, they're forbidden to do that. They feel that the flag is an idol, and that you are, in effect, bowing down to a false god, almost, to an idol, if you salute the flag. You see, they believe that Satan is behind the governments and that he controls them. In fact, in one of the Watchtower books, I remember a picture of a big, big hand, very sinister-looking hand, very dark and scary, and it had little strings attached to each of the fingers. And at the end of the strings were symbols of the political heads of the different governments. And it was Satan's hand, and he was like, those were like marionettes, and he was like the puppeteer, and he was playing the governments. That's why they're forbidden to salute the flag or to vote in a government.
And they will not serve in the military?
No, they will not serve in the military, no.
No, what are they? Will they actually serve as corpsmen like that, or just not fight, or they just won't serve at all? Are they all conscientious objectors?
Yes, they're not allowed to participate in the military. If they do, then they are viewed as having disassociated themselves from the organization, which they will be treated just as if they were thrown out. But what's really sad about this whole thing is usually the government, when they have a draft, the conscientious objectors will be respected, and they'll say, work in the hospital or do road work, or, you know, they'll give them some kind of alternative service to do. Well, in 1918, the Watchtower said, that's okay. If you don't want to go fight, you can do the alternative service. But in 1974, they say they got new light from Jehovah, like inspiration. And they said, no, you cannot take the alternative service. That's just as bad as being in the army. So you have to go to prison. And there's so many brothers, I knew several, who served prison time, because they were not allowed to go into the military or take the alternative service. And it's really funny, because most people, when they say, oh, look at that guy there, he went to prison, you're kind of skeptical about this person. But with the witnesses, they point to them like it's a trophy almost. Look at that brother, he served in prison. It's really strange. But it's really very sad, because in 1996, Jehovah shed new light once again, and it's okay to accept the alternative service.
Well, why does Jehovah keep changing his mind?
Yeah, that's what I started wondering after a while. I thought, is he not capable of sending his message right? Or, you know, why is it, I viewed it like a TV set. Like a TV set picks up signals from the air and broadcasts it through the screen. Well, the Watchtower Society is kind of like that. They get their signals from Jehovah, and they broadcast it through their literature. I thought, what's the matter with their TV screen? Why is it so full of static? And then the thought dawned on me, maybe the Watchtower's TV set isn't even plugged in.
Well, how many years were you in the Jehovah's Witnesses?
25 years.
25 years. And, of course, and did you remarry in the in Jehovah's Witnesses?
Yes, I did. I got married when I was only 19, and I was not a witness then, and then I had a son, and then there was a divorce, and then I got remarried to a witness man. And that is really, it's a not easy thing for women, because women in the organization are not viewed as equals to the men at all. They're extremely subservient, and the women have to be in total submission to their husbands and to the other men in the congregation, unless they're asked to do something that breaks the law or breaks God's law. But if it doesn't do that, the woman has to obey, and she cannot show any disagreement with the men, even by her facial expression.
Well, you said that, though, that is there an exception to that if she's asked to do something, or what were you referring to?
Well, for example, what happened to me is my husband said, I want you to quit work and stay at home and take care of the kids, take care of the family. I want you to make a different meal every night of the year and don't make the same meal twice in 1 year. This is a real tough thing to do. And I had to do it because it didn't break Caesar's law and it didn't break God's law. And so the man is allowed to rule his house like that. And if you get a man, as I did, who likes to show superiority, then you're kind of, it's a very disadvantage for a woman because there's no way out. You're not allowed to divorce unless your husband commits immorality, sexual immorality, and he didn't do that. So I had no choice. He forced me to sew all the clothes for the kids and myself when I had no idea how to sew. Things like that.
All right, fine. So how long were you married then?
30 years.
Okay. And first, how many children did you have with that marriage?
I had one with that marriage.
Okay, that was your daughter then.
Yes.
All right, and of course, that was the one that they wanted you to disavow. And when you wouldn't do it, did they put you out of the society? You just quit going to the meetings.
Oh, well, what happened is I was already not going to the meetings very much at this point. And finally, after 3 months of shunning her, I told my husband. My husband was an elder in the congregation, by the way, and elders, they're very, very powerful. They're more powerful than a minister of a congregation because they really hold your life in their hands. They have the power to throw you out. So I told him, I can't stand it anymore. I'm going to go see Stephanie. And he said, then you know what I have to do. And he turned me in to the body of elders, and they called the next guy who's up over them, called the circuit overseer. They called him. He's sort of like a supervisor of about 10 congregations. He and the presiding elder, they were in my living room the very next day, and I thought that they were going to throw me out. They gave me severe chastisement because I did go visit my daughter. And then after about half an hour of that, and I thought, oh boy, they're going to throw me out, I was greatly shocked when the circuit overseer, who was an elderly man, he was more kind man. And he said, I can understand how difficult this must be for you as a mother to have to shun your daughter. So if you want to see your daughter, just take her to the back of a smoky restaurant and don't tell anybody about it.
All right, fine. So at least he had some compassion and maybe even a little sense of humor. So then you did maintain your relationship with your daughter.
Yeah, I did. But he says, if anyone comes to know of this, any witness, then we will disfellowship you. So you have to keep it a secret.
And because he knew, and the other men knew, and did your husband know, too?
About
you taking her to the back of a smoking restaurant?
Oh, yeah, my husband was sitting there in on this meeting. And the presiding elder of the congregation heard that, too. And it was so funny, the reaction he had. His mouth hung open, his jaw dropped to the floor. I mean, his teeth almost fell out. He was squirming around in his chair so nervously because it was quite shocking that this his superior would give me that kind of counsel.
Well, at least, he must have had some serious questions in his own mind, as to what they were really all about. But, you know, Chris, this is a wonderful thing to have all that power and to be able to lord it over people. But, of course, the fact that your husband would turn you in, his loyalty was not to you. It was
right.
To the Jehovah's Witnesses.
It's always the loyalty is to the organization before your spouse, before your children, before anyone.
And now, if somebody was a woman were to divorce her husband in the Jehovah's Witnesses, would she then be disowned by everybody in the family?
It depends why she divorced him.
It was not because of immorality.
Right, if she just got fed up or something, she would be socially ostracized. She would be what they call marked. And this means they would give, the elders would give a little speech into the congregation, and they would advise them to not socialize with that person. They could still talk to her in the Kingdom Hall to encourage her to, you know, be a good witness, but they wouldn't be allowed to socialize with her because they'd be afraid that she's like leaven, and they don't want her to, her bad attitude to affect the other women. And then she would not be allowed to remarry either. If a divorce happens because of no sexual infidelity involved, then the witness is not free to marry anybody. And if they do, then they're thrown out.
I see. But if she were to, of course, divorce her husband and leave the Jehovah's Witnesses, then nobody in the Jehovah's Witnesses could have anything to do with her after that.
Yes, that's right.
Well, did this happen very often, you know, or were the people fairly loyal? Because, you know, there seemed to be an awful lot of Jehovah's Witnesses, and they really seem to feel so deeply about their religion.
They give the appearance of feeling very deeply about it, and many of them do, but it's not coming out of a good place, in my opinion. It's coming out of a place of fear. They go knock on the doors. They tell you, I'm here. I knock on your door because Armageddon is going to happen soon. Oh, you know, we need to teach you the truth so that you can be saved. We're here out of love. But they're also there out of fear. And most people don't know that. But they are there because they fear that Jehovah will kill them at Armageddon if they don't go to the doors. With every available minute that they have, they need to go knocking on the doors.
Well, they certainly are dedicated, you know, and I sometimes wish that the Christians were half as dedicated as the Jehovah's Witnesses or the Mormons.
Well, yeah, they do give that appearance of being so dedicated, but like I say, it's coming out of not a place of love. It's coming out of a place of fear of disobeying Jehovah because he's going to kill me. They have to act loving to each other, even if they can't stand each other's personality, because Jehovah will kill them if they don't. It's a forced thing. It's not coming out of their heart, usually. Now, I'm speaking for myself. I'm speaking for witnesses that I knew.
Well, now it sounds, though, that you got a lot of support there. Didn't a lot of the women help you when you first joined and helped babysit your infant son so that you could get a job and work? And was there a real sense of support there for you?
Right in the beginning, but I wasn't baptized yet. I was just studying with one of the witnesses, and I was learning the doctrines. And at that time, they surround you with love. I mean, they literally will surround you in the Kingdom Hall, and they'll all give you hugs and, oh, how can I help you? And it's like instant friends, instant family. They did babysit my son for free so I could go to work because I couldn't afford to pay a babysitter and I couldn't afford just to stay home on welfare. They did all these things for me, but things changed drastically after I got baptized as a witness.
And so how did it change at that point?
The women who were babysitting my child started demanding my food stamps as payment, for one thing. They no longer wanted to babysit him for free.
So, you know, it really was more of an act to bring you on in, and once you're in, why, they've got you, is that it?
Yeah, that's kind of it. And when you study about cults, this kind of behavior is known as love bombing.
And, of course, this is very, I mean, this is what the Moonies use. This is certainly what the Mormons use, although the Mormons really are very, very supportive of one another. They are really an amazing organization. I never knew a Mormon didn't like. The problem with the Mormons is that their belief is that of the serpent in the Garden of Eden, and that is that you can be as God. And the Mormons believe they can become gods, you know, in some future life.
Wow. Well, I guess the witnesses get a little close to that with their doctrine of 144,000 becoming rulers in heaven, but it's not quite the same.
Well, what finally motivated you to just say, I'm getting out of here once and for all?
Well, I finally decided that I couldn't sever my relationship with my daughter, so I became inactive, and during that time, I started researching the history of the organization. And this was very difficult to do because it's hard to get a hold of the old copies of the books, like from, you know, 100 years ago and all along. But the Kingdom Halls, they have a library in each one. And they're full of these books. And I went in there to look at one, and one of the elders, they came in there, they grabbed that book out of my hand, and they said, you don't need to be reading this. You can read the new literature. And they told me to leave. And so it was very difficult, but I finally came into acquaintance with a man who has a very extensive library of old Watchtower literature, and I was able to borrow some of that and read those things. And I, studying the history of the organization, it just became evident to me that how can they say, we are the truth, we are the only channel of communication between God and the whole humankind. We are God's mouthpiece. Everything we say is as if it's the voice of God. When I realized, when I started studying the history, that their doctrines vacillate greatly. They're in a constant state of flux almost. And they keep changing them this way, that way, like with the alternative service that I mentioned before. You know, yes, you can do it. No, you can't. Yes, you can. People are getting hurt. People, those men who served in the prison sentence, their whole life is affected by that. People die from some of the changes in their doctrines. Like they have medical doctrines. For example, they forbid organ transplants in 1967, calling it cannibalism. But in 1980, Jehovah shed new light, and it's okay. They did the same thing with vaccinations. They forbid it in 1921. They forbid vaccinations all during the smallpox epidemic right up until 1952. Who knows how many people died because of that. And then, oh, Jehovah shed new light, and it was okay. And so on. I mean, hemophiliacs were denied blood clotting factor for 15 years until they were allowed to have it in 1978. So when I saw that these doctrines were killing people and hurting them, and yet they claim that at every zigzag...
Well, we're going to have to just take a break there, and we'll be right back in just a moment with Diane Wilson, and of course her book, Awakening of a Jehovah's Witness. Well, Dr. Stan, back here at Radio Liberty, our guest this evening, Diane Wilson, Awakening of a Jehovah's Witness. Diane, how can people get copies of your book?
They can go to any bookstore. It's on the bookshelves of the most of the major stores. Any bookstore can order it. They can also get it online through Amazon or Barnes & Noble. They can also go to my website, which is www.dianewilson.net, and that's spelled DianeWilson.net.
All right, DianeWilson.net, and you can get the book there, Amazon. And it's really very, very well written. And did you ever get back, I mean, who actually originated the Watchtower Society? Who originated Jehovah's Witness? What was their history and what was their objective?
It was back in 1875 by the man of name of Charles Taze Russell. He was involved in the Second Adventist movement, that religion. And after a while, he disagreed with some of the doctrines, so he left.
No, this was Seventh-day Adventist you're speaking of.
No. This was called the Second
Adventist. The Second Adventist, okay.
Mm-hmm. And then he left, and he took some of the Adventist beliefs, he kept some of them, left some other ones, and he called his group the International Bible Students. And then in the year 1931, the name was changed to Jehovah's Witnesses. But they are closely related to the Seventh-day Adventists.
All right. Well, Kirsten, he said that the end of the world was going to come up. Was the first date?
I believe it was 1874.
All right, fine. And then, of course, it was 19-something.
1914. And there's a lot of dates in between because, like, in the 1940s, oh, it's going to happen, it's going to happen. When the World Wars happened, oh, it's Armageddon. You know, so there was a lot of little dates that was... always going to happen, always going to happen.
Okay, and of course it never did happen. Didn't they lose an awful lot of their members when it didn't happen?
Actually, it's really strange that the witnesses, I mean, some did leave after the 1975 fiasco, but when Armageddon didn't happen, but for some strange reason, it kind of, they show more, even more fervor. They say, look, we were wrong. Jehovah corrected us. It's not really 75, but it's going to be. And so they view that correction from Jehovah as a sign that Jehovah is with the group. So we have to stay with the group.
Now, when is the next date? Do they have another new date yet?
No, they don't have a date now. Actually, 1994 was kind of a date. They never really announced it as a date, but the witnesses knew that... the Watchtower Society says that the beginning of the time of the end of the system of things started in 1914, and Armageddon would happen before the generation of 1914 died. And so the witnesses, they point to some scripture that speaks of a generation as being either 70 or 80 years. So if you add even 80 years to 1914, you're going to come out with 1994 as the last possible date that this could happen. And, of course, it didn't happen.
Right. Well, they basically have about how many members in the Watchtower Society today?
There's about 6 million.
About 6 million are they, in the United States or all throughout the world?
That's throughout the world. I think there's about 1 million in the United States.
And where are they strong? Are they strong in Europe or where else in the world?
Well, there are all over the world. I don't actually know which place is the strongest.
Well, wouldn't it be the United States? Would they be the strongest or some of the other countries are stronger?
I tend to think the United States personally because we're allowed freedom of religion here, whereas in some countries they're not allowed freedom of religion and they have to kind of go underground. It's not as easy for them to get new converts that way.
Well, of course, you finally decided you're just going to quit going to the meetings and you were meeting with your daughter and trying to get her life straightened out. And then when did you finally decide, I'm going to quit this whole thing?
When I started seeing how those zigzagging doctrines and the history of so many of them, and I thought, they claim to be the truth, but how can point A be the truth and point B, and then they go back to point A, the darkness that they supposedly left behind, then they change it to something else, zigzag, zigzag. I thought, they are so confused. How can this possibly be of God? And at that point, I was able to make the break.
All right, fine. And of course, your husband then did stay on, though, and he divorced you because you had left the Watchtower Society?
Yeah, he was an elder at the time that I left, and he was plenty angry, and it was not a happy sight at our house. He was very angry that I left, and it was a big embarrassment to him because the witness men, particularly the witness elders, are supposed to have their wife under their thumb, complete subservience. They're supposed to have the wife in subjection. And obviously he did not have control of me any longer because I went and left the organization.
Were most of the wives subservient to their husbands?
Oh, yeah, you have to be or you get thrown out.
Okay, well, let's go talk to Mike here. Hi, Mike, how are you doing?
Hi, Stan. I just want to ask your guest a question. And again, thanks for having her on. This is really wonderful. I've got a question about Watchtower doctrine. And as I understand it, their doctrine falls apart around the orthodox doctrine of the resurrection of Christ. And in the New World Translation, John chapter 2, verses 19 through 22, I won't read the whole thing, but here Christ is being asked the question, he says, break down this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up. Therefore, the Jews said this temple was built in 46 years, and will you raise it up in 3 days? But he was talking about the temple of his body, and he was, of course, speaking about his own body. And then in Luke, again from the New World Translation, chapter 24, he's in the upper room, and he says, see, my hands and my feet, that is what I myself feel me and see because that it is I myself feel me and see because a spirit does not have flesh and bones just as you behold that I have. And so I've been curious for a long time. I've used these passages in my discussions with Jehovah's Witnesses, and they come to a dead standstill when they read this for themselves in their own text. And I know they go back to their meetings and probably ask questions, and maybe after that they get thrown out.
But Mike, what is the point? Do they do not believe in the bodily resurrection of Jesus Christ? Is that
right? How in the world does the Watchtower doctrine fall apart around the doctrine of the resurrection?
Well, they have quite a different view of Jesus than typical mainstream Christianity. They believe that Jesus was actually Michael the Archangel, and that was the first creative creation that God made, Jehovah made. And then he came down to the earth in the form of Jesus, and then he became a spirit and went back to be Michael the Archangel up there. So it's really different.
So they don't really believe he was then the Son of God, or that he was basically both God and man and died and was resurrected?
They believe that he's the Son of God, but not that he's God himself. They don't believe in the Trinity at all.
All right.
And then, of course, also the bodily resurrection, as is promised to us as followers of Christ at the end of the age.
Yeah, it's interesting that you're bringing out those scriptures that do talk about, it seems to lead to the belief of a bodily resurrection, but it's interesting, a phenomena happens with the witnesses. If the watchtower says black is white, then you can look at black and see white.
Mm-hmm.
So when you read these scriptures to the witnesses, they hear it, they come to a standstill because they're caught in sort of a conflict. They're hearing something, but they know it's not true, and they just don't quite know how to explain it, maybe.
Well, you know, the one thing I've always been very impressed with was that the witnesses spend a lot of time in the Bible. They know the Bible very well. Do they have a special Watchtower Bible where they've actually changed some of the scriptures?
Yes, they do. It's called the New World Translation of the Holy Scriptures. It used to be popular in a green cover. They used to make it only in a green cover, and so people got to know that that's the witness Bible. And when that happened and people started objecting to them using it, they just made the cover in black. But at the time that I was a witness, I was told that that was the most accurate Bible translation on the earth. And that's what I taught people. But when I came out, I realized that some of the scriptures are changed in there to reflect witness doctrine.
At least they're honest enough to put those changes in parentheses. But it comes from the Watchtower.
Yeah.
They purport to be these prophets of God.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, anything else, Mike?
That's all, thanks.
Okay, fine, thanks very much. Well, you know, Diane, of course, then you would decide you're going to leave. But you had a lot of baggage at this. Were you seeing a psychologist or psychiatrist or something for a time?
Yes, what happened in 1988 is my father, who I was very close to, my parents were not Jehovah's Witnesses, but I was very close to my dad, and he committed suicide in a very violent way. And 5 weeks later, my mother committed suicide. And so I was left in kind of an emotional trauma. And my medical doctor said, I want you to see a psychologist to help you through the grieving process because you're internalizing it. And so that's how I happened to go to see a psychologist. While we were working on the death of my parents, I wasn't even allowed to go to my father's funeral because it was in a little Catholic chapel in the cemetery. So it was very difficult for me. So I was seeing him to deal with that. And then after a period of time, months went by, all of a sudden my daughter gets disfellowshipped. And so we start talking about that.
Now, Michelle, your daughter is disfellowshipped from what?
From the Jehovah's Witnesses.
Oh, okay, fine. Oh, I'm sorry. All right, fine. So this was, you were still a good, loyal Jehovah's Witness at this time.
Yes. Yes, that's right. So that's how I happened to see the psychologist, because otherwise I wouldn't have been seeing him, because the witnesses, it's like the Watchtower doesn't allow you to see a psychologist, but they don't throw you out if you go see one. But
and it was the Watchtower that wouldn't let you go to your father's funeral then.
Yes, now they forbid me to go to a church. If I put my foot in the church at that funeral, I would have been thrown out.
Okay, so much for tolerance and compassion and all these other things. Well, our telephone number is 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. So anyway, you're going to see a psychologist. Your daughter's been thrown out, and you're beginning to think, I'm going to get out of this thing myself.
Right, and it was this psychologist was very kind, and he was not a specialist in this religion or anything, but what he helped me to do was to take back what is rightfully mine, in other words, my ability to think for myself. And that was the big gift that he gave me. He worked with me for 2 years, helping me to realize that I can think independently, that I'm not going to die if I'm outside of the organization. I used to go in his office and I'd say, I'm going to die. And then I would look at him and he was so full of peace and he was so kind and gentle. And I thought, wow, maybe I could have that kind of peace someday. Maybe he could help me to have that. And that's what I finally do have, since I've been able to now take back my thinking process and think independently of the Watchtower.
All right, well, let's go to Tony, who's calling from, of all places, SoCal. Hi, Tony. How are you doing?
Oh, it's not that bad a place. Hi, Dr. Stan.
Good. Okay, you have a question for Diane.
Diane, did you ever read a book? I forget the author, but it was called Jehovah's Witnesses, Apostles of Denial.
I've heard of it, but no, I haven't read it. I think it's kind of an older book, isn't it?
Yeah. The fellow had been in the Watchtower Society for like 38 years. I forget what his name was, though. It's been quite a while. The one thing that kind of got me to call was when Mike called and mentioned the scripture about how when Jesus had destroyed his temple and I will raise it again in 3 days, I've used that scripture in the past to witness to Jehovah's Witnesses. Now, I call them JWs because I don't like to use God's name in vain. But that's why I'm only going to say that once. But on that verse, I'll ask them who raised Jesus from the dead, and they will always say the same thing.
They'll say Jehovah did.
Right. But in Galatians, it says that the Spirit of God, the Holy Spirit of God, raised him from the dead. And then Jesus also said that he raised himself from the dead. You know, destroyed his temple, and I will raise it in 3 days. So the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit all raised Jesus from the dead. And that really causes them to pause for a few moments. But there's several other scriptures that you know that they have problems with. John 1:1 is one. You know, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Now, in that New World Interlinear, I can't say it.
Greek Interlinear.
Yeah. Well, they've changed that to, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was a God.
Yes.
And they quote Julius Manti as their authority, you know, foremost Greek scholar, for why it is a God. Well, he sued them for misquoting him.
I heard about that.
Yeah. And then, you know, they still refused to retract their quoting of him to just, you know, as their little thing to say that it's a God and not God. But the one place in their interlinear—I can't say that word. I'm sorry.
Interlinear.
Yeah. The one place where they have never, where they haven't changed, is John 20:28, when doubting Thomas saw Jesus, and Jesus said to him, you know, "Thomas, come and see that it is I." You know, and John 20:28, and Thomas fell before Jesus and declared, "My Lord and my God." Capital G. And I'll ask them about that. And I've talked to elders in the Watchtower Society. You know, I don't want to say the JW word, but I've talked. In fact, one time I talked to this one guy for over 3 hours.
Wow.
And he had been in the Watchtower for over 30 years. And I talked to this guy for over 3 hours, and we over and over, discussed the same things. And but when Thomas declared, "My God," do you know how they explain that one?
Why don't you tell us?
They say that when Thomas saw the holes in Jesus' hands, that he was saying, "Oh, my God, look at those holes."
Okay, Tony, anything else you want to say?
Well, just I've got one other one. That,
all right, fine.
Because I'm quite familiar with these guys.
All
but,
right, fine.
But when about 25 years ago, I had the misfortune of studying with these people for a while. And on April 1st, 1975, they came out with a book. It was called Our Incoming New World Government. And at that time, I was really beginning to try to find the answer to the last two verses of the book of Daniel. And those two verses of chapter 12, verse 12 and 13, talk about the abomination of desolation, which is established on the 1290th day. And then there's the following verse that says, "Blessed and holy is he who liveth and endureth till the 1335th day." And I wanted to know, in their view, what was the 1290th day? In fact, I spoke to Dr. Walter Martin about this when he was still alive. But this is what they said in that book. This is what the abomination of desolation is. They said that the 1290th day was the sixth day of a nine-day Bible Convention of the Philadelphia Bible Students, which were later to become known as the Jehovah's Witnesses. So they declared in their own work that they are the abomination of desolation.
Okay, fine. Thanks so much, Tony.
You know, that's one thing that always bothered me, is that the Watchtower uses their own history, and they take things like that are symbolic, like in the book of Revelation, and they apply it to the history of the Watchtower Society. And when they started doing that, I thought, oh, good grief, this is the most ridiculous thing.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Stan, if you'd just bear with me for one moment, but they also, do you know who the original church founder of the Jehovah's Witnesses is? Of the seven, they have seven church founders. Do you know who the first one they claim to be is?
Who?
His name was Arius. And Arius was one who, let's just say, battled with Athanasius in 325 at the Council of Nicaea over the divinity of Christ. He was the first Jehovah's Witness. And I will say it in this way, because it's not using it in vain. But at that council in 325, there was a big division in the church over the divinity of Christ. And Arius was one of the first he was the first that wanted to to say that Jesus was not God, but that he was created. Well, after the council, this is in the history books, if you look deep enough, Arius was found, he was sitting under a tree, and I will add this part, contemplating his heresy, when a sudden violent shaking came upon him and his bowel gushed out. And they claim him as their church founder.
Well, maybe they should go with the other guy, that Echinacius. Okay, thanks so much, Tony. Let's go to Eric from Compton. Hi, Eric. How are you doing?
Hi, Chuck. I'm fine. How are you?
I'm doing fine.
I can remember Miss Wilson. Those were some of my... It's been a little lukewarm lately, I'm sorry to admit, but that was some of my most exciting times of studying the Word of God, when I was comparing Jehovah Witness doctrine with Bible, real Bible doctrine.
Mm-hmm.
I learned a lot from that. I got a friend interested in that, in studying with me, and he just went a lot further than I did. You should see his library. He has such a library of their own books. The best thing to use against these people really is their own writings.
Yes, absolutely.
But the points that I had was, it was always exciting to me to show them how the message has changed, how like in Acts 5:42, they went door to door. Yeah, but they went door to door, teaching and preaching Jesus. Mm-hmm. I try and show them how you don't teach and preach Jesus. And then Paul said, if anybody comes with another message, let them be accursed.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my thing. His thing was showing them that you have to call upon the name of Jesus. I wanted to ask you, in your opinion, I think that the name the guy was looking for, by the way, I have his book. His name is William Schnell.
Oh, so he wrote the book.
Schnell.
30
yeah.
Years of Watchtower Slave.
30 Years of Watchtower Slave, yeah. He wrote a couple others.
It's a very old book.
Yeah, it is. Oh. I want to ask you, in your opinion, what do you think is, I mean, I've used all those doctrines, all those that the previous callers have mentioned, showing Jesus is God, what Thomas said, every proper name that God claims for himself, Jesus claims. I mean, we've run the gambit. One thing I've learned from talking to these people, no matter how crazy, how ludicrous the answer is, they always have an answer.
Yes.
So they're very well trained. They really are.
Very well trained. We as Christians should be so well fired up and trained. But in your opinion, Ms. Wilson, what do you think the best point that you could bring up to these people just to start to get them to think?
I would think, pose to them a hypothetical situation and say, if Jehovah were to lead you beyond the watchtower, would you go? And probably the witness will say no. And then you could say, you might think about whether your devotion is really to the watchtower or to Jehovah. That might get them to think a little bit.
Well, you can, and after all, if it's really God is right and God is just, then why do the teachings of the Watchtower keep changing? Hey, thanks so much, Eric. Anything else?
Okay, thank you, Ms. Wilson. No, that'd be all.
Bye-bye. Let's go to Dale calling in. Hi, Dale. Question or comment?
Question for both of you. Very briefly, I understand that the founder of the Jehovah Witnesses, Charles Taze Russell, he was also a 33rd degree Mason, and I'll take your comments off the air.
All right, good question, Dale, and I wasn't going to get into that, but I think it's well worthwhile. Thanks so much. Yes, did you know that Russell was a Mason?
I had heard that he was.
Right, and of course, you know, see, Jehovah's Witnesses comes out of Masonry, Mormonism comes out of Masonry. My goodness, those people are into everything. And of course, they're all to draw people away from the true gospel of Jesus Christ. Let's go to Lorraine calling from San Diego. Hi, Lorraine. Question or comment?
I had a comment that
is
I wanted
the same Lorraine who called me at on my early morning program,
it's
too?
The same one.
All right, good. Always good to hear from you.
What I was going to say is that something positive about Jehovah's Witness is they don't believe in taking oaths, so they make my life easier. Because I don't believe in that either because of Matthew 6, and then I think there's the verse in James, and Ecclesiastes, there's like two. And, they've made this easier because they don't believe in it either. It used to be the Reformed Church didn't believe it, but they've changed. And I think that's a positive thing about them. Also, too, people that aren't Jehovah's Witness say, they're not a racist organization, even though they're very strict, and that's a lot of things people say against them. I just wanted to bring that one thing up. I'm not Jehovah's Witness, but there is some positive there because they've made strides in the court. People like me have a little more foundation to say, hey, you know, I can't take this oath because my Bible tells me I shouldn't take oaths.
Okay, you're absolutely, it's a good point. Yes, there has to be some good things there to get as many good people into it.
Yeah.
Okay?
All right, thank you.
God bless you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Let's go to Richard from Florida. Richard, we're just about out of time. Quick question or comment?
Quick comment. What I notice about the Jehovah's Witnesses is that they're among the most stubborn people that I've come across to witness. I mean, they're so closed-minded. You cannot bring their God is the God of the Watchtower, as I call it. You know.
Let's get Diane's response to that. What would you say in response to Richard saying that these people are just closed-minded? They only think of things one way, and that's the God of the Watchtower.
That's it. It's the Watchtower's way or the highway. When you're a witness, you're not allowed to have independent thoughts. What the Watchtower says is absolute truth from God, and that's it. And you're not going to sway him from that.
Amen to that. Either that or it's the highway. Thanks so much, Richard. We're out of time.
It's a very strong principality operating in that organization.
I think you're absolutely right.
Well, they're totally dogmatic and legalistic organization, for sure.
Okay. Good night. God bless.
God bless you,
okay.
Dr.
And Diane, I want to thank you so much. It's been fascinating. I really enjoyed having you with me.
Thank you. Oh, I'd like to mention that
I'm having a
book signing.
Okay.
I'll be having a book signing on April 26th from 1 o'clock to 3 o'clock in Pacific Grove at a store called The Bookworks.
That's April 26th?
Yes, April 26th, and it's located at 667 Lighthouse Avenue. That's sort of the main drag in Pacific Grove.
All right, fine. Well, if you have a chance to get down there to visit Lorraine at the book signing on the 26th, why, be sure to do it.
And I'd like to point out my website, again, has a lot of reviews, and I would encourage people to go there to www.dianewilson.net and read the reviews.
Okay. God bless you. And thanks so much, Diane.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And I really enjoyed having Diane on with us. She does a very good job, and I'm fascinated by the book, and I think we'll have Diane on to some of our other programs. And I think it's so important, as Chris was pointed out, that Mr. Russell, who originated this, came out of Masonry, as did the founders of Joseph Smith, who founded Mormonism. So all of these, of course, to take people away from the true gospel. And when you understand that, and of course that both of these are cults, both of them have a lot of good people in them, but it's their way or no other way, you begin to understand what we're really up against. Well, this is the time when we have to remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and we hope that many of you will seriously consider joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters. And, of course, if you'd like a free copy of our newsletter, you don't have to be bashful. Let me tell you that the March newsletter will really give you an overview of course, the secret little group Well, it's not secret now. They've got a website, the Project for the New American Century. But the people who planned the war with Iraq, not about weapons of mass destruction, but really about establishing a situation where America would dominate the world and bring about this new world order. So certainly go to their website, understand that. But even more, if you'd like a free copy of my March newsletter that covers that, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Pray for America. Pray for our boys over in Iraq and their families. Pray that this war will be concluded very, very soon and successfully. And then pray for revival in America. Because, of course, if the American people don't turn back to God, why we will lose America. And lastly, we ask you to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. And so until tomorrow, I guess it'll be Monday now, this is Dr. Stan King. Good night, and may the Lord be with you.
Allowing the public health authority, please get out of there. Thank you. Allowing the public health authority to be able to quarantine if there's any disease coming out. Did that work? Did you hear that, Dr. Stan?
No, I didn't, but I would be surprised.
Yeah.
What did you hear?
On KKNC on the news?
I wouldn't be surprised.
I'm just going to go into the internet, maybe tomorrow.
Okay, whatever you get, let me know. And are you ready to do the program we talked about?
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to come out.